previously on Unsolved.
There were certain Catholic prophecies that said there's going to be a problem, maybe world war, you know, Fatima message, all that. So I ran into a little trouble because, guided by a priest, I borrowed a couple statues, see? And so I got in trouble. And then since I was in trouble, then they jumped on that opportunity to throw me into the mix.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, Season 3, The Devil You Know. I'm Gina Barton. It was fairly common knowledge that Father Alfred Kuntz left the doors to St. Michael Church unlocked. He did this so people could come in to pray anytime they needed to. Initially, some people thought his killer might have taken advantage of that and just walked right into the school to kill Father Kuntz. But the police figured out pretty quickly that even though the church and school were connected, it wasn't so easy to get into the school. Remember, Father Kuntz actually lived inside the school, where he had a small apartment. Gwen Rupert has been the lead detective on the case for the past 6 years or so.
It's my understanding that it was mostly left open. The church was, but again, the door was locked between the church and the school, and you couldn't get through it. You could walk from the school to the church into it, but it was, you know, one-way locked going into the south part where the school was.
That didn't change when the church was robbed a few weeks before Father Kuntz was killed. Here's Detective Don Johnson, who was in charge of the case for the first 2 years.
One of the things that supported burglary is that the church had been broken into not that long before the homicide. And Father Kuntz was actually kind of listening and waiting to see if they were come back.
Despite that, Father Kuntz wasn't all that security conscious.
Yeah, we heard that story from a number of different people that he'd be on the phone with them late or early into the morning hours. And yeah, he'd open the door for people at a time when we as law enforcement might be saying, be careful about who you're opening the door to, know who it is standing outside that door.
Some people who knew Father Kuntz told me he let homeless people stay in the church or in a home the church owned down the street, which people called the White House. In 1998, the White House was basically empty. A group of nuns had once used it as a convent, but Father Kuntz had dismissed them several years earlier. Detective Rupert said Father Kuntz was well known for being welcoming and generous to strangers, but she didn't know if he went as far as letting homeless people sleep in the White House.
So was it true that he actually, like, also let homeless people stay there, or was it mostly, like, visiting priests and...
I never heard
a story that
homeless people stayed. Homeless people came and asked him for money,
right.
But I did not ever hear a story that he let people stay there.
Father Kuntz's friend, Peter Kelly, tells me Father Kuntz also didn't keep very good track of his money or of the church's money.
He was a spiritual advisor, but I don't know that there was as much attention given to the fiscal aspects of what was going on in Dane. A parish, as I understand it, runs on love and money. He had the love part down. He loved the people. He loved the faith. He loved to do his work. But you got to take care of the bucks. I remember saying after his death to one of the priests who was charged with kind of cleaning up around there fiscally. And I said, I conceded. I think Father Kuntz needed a good accountant. And the priest responded, Father Kuntz needed a bad accountant. He needed any accountant at all would have been nice. Even somebody who wasn't that good could have made a big bit of help.
Carrie Porter, the lieutenant of detectives, tells me police did explore potential financial motives for the murder.
Father Kuntz had total control over the church finances. There was the church council had been disbanded under Father Kuntz. I don't think it was ever suspected that Father Kuntz was pocketing money for his own gain, but there was definitely, he seemed to be pretty unorganized in his life anyway, and that included the financial end of that. Part of that is just he couldn't really figure out his finances and the church money coming in from the church, and there was always money being transferred. Even when there was plenty of money, it seemed like he was always late paying bills, and that just seems to be more of a disorganization than anything else.
One thing I had heard about Father Kuntz was that he kept a trash bag of money under his desk. I asked Lieutenant Porter if that was true.
There was cash located in his living quarters there, but not necessarily. It was very unorganized. So there was cash laying around in various areas that was unusual, which I suppose in one way would discredit the burglary, unless that it was interrupted before the burglary actually got underway and things were taken and then the panic set in and somebody left.
Father Kuntz also walked around with pockets full of money, and he was known to hand out some of that cash to people in need. Because of that, and because he kept the church doors unlocked, strangers were sometimes drawn to St. Michael. One of them may have been a convicted felon named Joe Cavanaugh. One of Joe Cavanaugh's uncles was a retired sheriff's deputy in Dane County, the same jurisdiction where Father Kuntz was murdered. So he knew the detectives working on the Kuntz case, and he told them he thought Joe was the killer. We'll get back to why he thought that later in the show. But first, I think it would be helpful for you to know a little bit more about Joe. I wasn't able to talk with him, but I found a former reporter who did extensive interviews with his family back in 2002, after Joe was arrested in an unrelated case. These days, Reed Magny does PR for the Wisconsin Elections Commission. But back then, he was a reporter at the La Crosse Tribune. That's in western Wisconsin, near the borders with Iowa and Minnesota. La Crosse is about 100 miles from Dane, where Father Kuntz was killed. And it's the city where Joe was born, in 1958. From what Reed tells me, Joe led a troubled life from the time he was a kid. His parents lost custody of him and his brother John and his sister Kathy, and the three of them were adopted by an aunt and uncle. Reed says Joe's adoptive parents were strict Catholics. They went to Mass every Sunday, and Joe and his brother were both altar boys. The couple tried hard to make a happy life for Joe and his siblings, but according to Joe's brother, it wasn't enough to spare Joe some additional trauma.
Joe had told him that he was sexually abused by some older man on French Island, which is a residential area just sort of west of La Crosse. It's a big island in the Mississippi River.
Joe made his brother promise never to tell their parents. And as far as Reed knows, he kept the secret. No one was ever arrested for molesting Joe. And Joe didn't get any type of counseling afterward.
Joe had run away from home a few times, when he was in school. And he lied about his age to enlist in the military, in the army, and was stationed in Germany.
At that point, Joe was just 17. He did not do well in the army. He wasn't in very close touch with his family. But when he did contact them, he would tell them all these stories they didn't quite believe. Like he told them he'd gotten married, and a few years later, he said his wife and their two kids all died in a car accident. But none of the family had ever talked to the supposed German wife or kids or seen pictures of them.
You know, they think that maybe Joe had bipolar disorder and didn't do well with authority, and that, you know, there was probably a bad situation than him getting into the military, where obviously as an enlistee, you have to have a very healthy respect for authority in order to make it in that situation.
Joe's brother said he came back a different person.
The impression that I got from talking with his family and from reading about him and everything is this was just personally my own introduction to exactly what the meaning of having a personality disorder is. He was someone who would manipulate others, either to draw attention to himself or to, you know, get the things that he needed or wanted.
After Joe left the army, he went home to La Crosse. That's when his trouble with the law began. We'll tell you about it after the break.
Hi, this is Allie, and I work with Gina and the Unsolved crew here at the Journal Sentinel. A thrilling drama plays out every time someone is taken hostage. A life hangs in the balance as captive and negotiator fight for the hostage's freedom. Say the wrong thing or make the wrong move, and the situation could end in tragedy. In Hostage, a podcast from the Parcast Network, you can hear the complicated stories behind the world's most intense hostage situations. What was going on behind the scenes? What happens to someone's brain when they are held captive? What psychological tactics do negotiators use to make sure a hostage comes home safely? Every Thursday, Hostage reveals the key moments in these situations. Sometimes they're the moments when things went tragically wrong. Sometimes they're the moments when lives are saved. You couldn't do a show called Hostage without telling the story of Patty Hearst. A three-part series on her kidnapping takes listeners through the twists and turns of what may well be the most well-known hostage situation in U.S. history. And be sure to catch the astonishing two-part episode on Captain Phillips of the MV Maersk, Alabama. That's on Hostage. Search for and subscribe to Hostage wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review.
After Joe left the military, the police found a troubling pattern of violence. Reed Magny did extensive research on Joe Kavanaugh's past crimes.
So in the early 1980s, when he had gotten back from the military, he had had an incident where he and a 19-year-old woman from La Crosse who he'd worked with had been drinking wine and had some sort of disagreement, and he hit her on the head with a bottle and had sexually assaulted her.
Joe ended up pleading guilty to a reduced charge of second-degree sexual assault. A judge sentenced him to a maximum term of 5 years in prison, even though a minister vouched for him at sentencing. This minister tried to convince the judge that Joe had found religion and wanted to continue his education and work with Christian youth. He made no mention of Joe's Catholic upbringing.
And it was interesting, in this case, it was a Baptist minister, I think, who had vouched for him.
Right, but, not a Catholic minister.
Right, yeah. There was elements of sort of religion from his being an altar boy, and then, you know, saying that he had found religion. I think that whether or not him, quote unquote, finding religion was, you know, something that he would use to try to get leniency or, you know, something like that.
Joe Kavanaugh was out of prison by the mid-1980s. Over the next several years, he ended up getting married and divorced 3 times. Among those marriages, he had 5 kids. Reed Magny tells me that during that time, Joe's mental health was deteriorating, and he was making up more and more stories. He would lie on his resume and then get fired when his employers found out. He could only keep a job for about 6 months at a time. But that was only the beginning. He told people he had cancer, but he showed no sign of being sick and no sign of getting treatment. He repeated the story about the car accident in Germany, and he also talked about other relatives getting into car accidents that hadn't actually happened. It was still more than 10 years before he got into any more serious trouble with the law. By then, his 3rd divorce had gone through, and he had a girlfriend, but they didn't live together. This woman asked Joe to set up her home computer and her account with America Online. This was back when the internet was brand new, so the setup was kind of complicated. Here's what Reed Magny was able to find out about Joe's scheme.
Joe knew the woman's work schedule, and he would get into her apartment using a keyless garage opener, and he used her AOL account and credit cards to order merchandise in her name, and then he'd be at her house during the day to take delivery, and eventually that house of cards came falling down, and she confronted him, and they broke up, and then that was April 3rd, 2002.
According to police and court records, Joe Kavanaugh got into the woman's house the next morning before she left for work. He tied her to the bed and raped her for more than 5 hours. He wouldn't let her leave. Eventually, she managed to call 911.
I guess he had a red Ford Mustang, and he led the officers on a 60 to 70 mile per hour chase through the neighborhood. He was trapped in a cul-de-sac and took off on foot, but he was caught. They charged him with kidnapping, burglary, 2 counts of second-degree sexual assault, robbery, and fleeing an officer.
So Joe was put back in jail as he awaited his trial. While he was locked up, his mental health just kept getting worse and worse.
he had, you know, made between, I think, 40 and 50 complaints to the jailers about needing medical assistance of some kind. He had told them that he had cancer and he was being treated at the Mayo Clinic, which, of course, they were never able to verify.
On August 6th, 2002, Joe Kavanaugh hung himself in the La Crosse County Jail. He was 43. So how did Joe Kavanaugh end up being investigated as a possible suspect in the Coons case? It started with a tip from Joe's uncle, John Kavanaugh. John had retired from the Dane County Sheriff's Department, the same agency that was investigating Father Coons' murder. John says that a few years before Father Coons' death, Joe's grandfather, who was elderly and used a wheelchair, was attacked in his home. He was found on the floor, bleeding and pretty seriously injured. He did recover, but he said he couldn't remember anything about the attack. According to John, Joe later confessed to another family member that he had gone to see his grandfather to ask him for money. And when his grandfather said no, Joe said he had to, quote, rough him up. Remember Matt Abbott, the Catholic commentator who's been writing about the Coons case for the past 15 years or so? John Kavanaugh told him something very similar happened after Father Coons was murdered.
John Kavanaugh believed that Joe could very well have been involved or could have committed the murder of Father Coons because that the nephew had at some point supposedly asked Father Coons for money and was turned down. And never really gave a, if you will, formal confession per se, but apparently made remarks to the fact that he had roughed Father Coons up. He had to rough him up.
Last summer, I tracked down John Kavanaugh to try and get some clarity on all of this.
Hello? Are you John?
He hadn't returned my phone calls, so photographer Mark Hoffman and I knocked on his door. He opened it, but he wasn't particularly eager to talk.
So we were in Madison today and just figured we'd swing on by and see if you had some time to chat.
No.
No?
No, really don't.
As we stood on his porch, John explained that the whole situation had put a lot of stress on him and on his wife, and he just wanted to put it behind him. But he did talk with us briefly.
I gave everything I had to Dane County. I called the FBI. I contacted the bishops and never heard back from any of them, the bishop in the Madison Diocese.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why do you think you didn't hear back from them?
I have no idea. I really don't.
Okay. You know,
I did everything I could to let them know what was going on, you know, and they didn't, to the best of my knowledge, again, unless you know better, I don't believe they'd ever sent anybody to La Crosse to even talk to him when he was in jail. Do you know?
I don't know that,
no.
But I can ask.
Yeah, well, yeah, whatever. Anyway, I appreciate your interest. I hope something comes of it, but again, I don't have any interest in getting involved with it.
I kept my word to John Kavanaugh. And I asked several people at the sheriff's department what went on with Joe Kavanaugh in terms of the Father Coons investigation. Here's the sheriff, Dave Mahoney.
Every priest I know would have given that individual money. If this was an issue of needing money, they probably would have given him money. And so to have to go to the level of violence to kill a priest, I thought was pretty over the top.
Still, Detective Gwen Rupert tells me Joe Kavanaugh was investigated pretty thoroughly.
They actually interviewed him. They interviewed his sister. Some of the story was that he had contacted the Sauk school system having to do with, like, you know, office machines that a school system would need or something. He was like a salesman or something. But we also think that was a complete farce story. But he'd contacted them, so he'd stayed with his sister that night.
Remember, Sauk is very close to St. Michael's. Around 10 miles or so. It's about 90 miles from Joe's home in La Crosse. Detective Rupert says Joe was not all that cooperative with detectives.
Pretty standoffish. I want to say he was on probation at the time, and he met with us because he had to, but he didn't. It wasn't a very free-flowing interview.
She says the detectives also worked to track Joe's whereabouts on the night of Father Kuntz's murder.
So he'd stayed with his sister that night. Like the day before the night Father Kuntz was killed. So we can't actually place him in the Dane area at all.
Okay.
That was completely run down. I mean, he was alibied with his wife, who I'm sure was absolutely terrified of him already at that point. Mm-hmm. But, and the sister too, as much as she's like, yeah, he was here. I don't know where he went from here. But then he didn't, as far as we know, he didn't come south or, you know, southeast to Dane.
Okay.
He was alibied out as much as we could at that time.
Detective Rupert told me that when the crime lab found new DNA on the evidence from the murder scene a couple of years ago, they compared it with Joe's.
We were able to find old tissue samples from his autopsy and take them to the lab where they pioneered a technique to get the tissue out of fixed wax blocks. And now they've done it for us twice, tested.
It didn't match. According to John Kavanaugh, the uncle, Joe actually spent the night before the murder with a cousin and was unaccounted for the night Father Kuntz was killed. John says Joe's wife at the time later said Joe threatened her, so she'd lied to the police. I wish I had been able to confirm this one way or the other, but I wasn't able to do it. I found a number for Joe's sister, but she has moved out of Wisconsin and didn't respond to my phone messages. I had no luck locating his brother or his ex-wife, or any other family members who were willing to talk to me. John Kavanaugh told me his feelings haven't changed since he first tipped off the sheriff's department about his nephew.
Do you still feel the same way you did back then when you called
him?
Yeah,
I think he killed the Father Kuntz.
Okay.
That's what I think.
Next time on Unsolved.
We had a very long talk, and I remember really being hard on him. I don't think I work on people to try to make them crack. I don't like the way that sounds, but I think I did with Brian. I really wanted to push him emotionally, get him back to that day and what was going on. And when somebody, I think, is pleading with their case as hard as he was, he gets emotional and he's crying about it. I mean, he really broke down.
That's all for this week. To see the criminal complaint filed against Joe Kavanaugh, visit jsonline.com/unsolved. We've also posted police reports, photos, maps, videos, and timelines, so you can explore the case on your own. Before we go, I wanted to tell you about a new true crime podcast I think you'll like. It's called Case Closed, and it's made by our friends at Macmillan. Season 1 of Case Closed tells the story of Erin Corwin, a young military wife who was murdered in 2014. She was living with her husband, John, a Marine corporal who was stationed at 29 Palms in California, when she left to scout hiking trails in Joshua Tree National Park. She never came back. 2 months later, her body was found dumped in an abandoned mine shaft deep in the desert. Case Closed won't leave you wondering. By the end of the season, you'll find out who killed Erin Corwin and why. You can subscribe to Case Closed on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Unsolved is reported, written, and produced by me, Gina Barton. Our sound engineer and videographer is Bill Schultz. Photographer, Mark Hoffman. Artist, Lou Saldivar. Web designers, Aaron Coy and Andrew Malika. Our editor of local news and investigations is Greg Borowski. Our copy editor is Debbie Davis. Our theme music this season was composed by Evan Johnson. I also want to thank Donna Billmeyer, Miles Moffitt, Ashley Lutheran, Meg Jones, Tom Ketting, Rachel Piper, Emily Risto, Anissa Johnson, Rick Wood, Brian Kranz, Joe Hanneman, Elena Weissman, and Taylor Palmby for their help this season. And please support local journalism. You can subscribe to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at jsonline.com/deal. Thank you.